Did you hear them talking about it on the radio? Did you try to read the writing on the wall? Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over again. Day by day, I hear the voices rising, starting with a whisper like it did before. Day by day, we count the dead and dying, ship the bodies home, while an inward talk keeps going. Did you hear them talking about it on the radio? Could your eyes believe the writing on the wall? Heard it all before. It's like deja vu all over again. One by one, see the old ghost rising, stumbling across big muddy where the light gets dim. Day after day, another mama's crying, she's lost her precious child to a war that has no end. Did you
That was John Fogerty with Deja Vu All Over Again. And now for Jav Parrish with Undermining the War Effort.
Undermining the War Effort. This is Jav Parrish. Reports of the alleged execution of up to 24 Iraqi civilians by U.S. Marines in the city of Haditha last November have been floating around since February. Until recently, Haditha generated a disinterested murmur, barely louder than that of all the other reports of U.S. killings of numbers of Iraqi civilians that have surfaced in the last 3 years. But a Time magazine report and a subsequent U.S. military investigation have suddenly turned Haditha into a major story. And so it was that Pentagon ally and war critic Representative Jack Murtha made headlines last Sunday when he pronounced that Haditha might be, quote, worse than Abu Ghraib for its potential to undermine the U.S. war effort. Let's set aside for a moment the most obvious response to Murtha's concern. How can you undermine a complete disaster? Murtha's reasoning bugs me. A lot. Both for what it says about the American public's idea of war, and for a rather patronizing idea of Iraqis. Every poll shows that a supermajority of the Iraqi public would like to see at least a timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal, if not an immediate pullout. But somehow Murtha, and for Representative Murtha, you may insert the thinking of most anyone among the Beltway political class, somehow Murtha is concerned that Haditha will sour the opinions of Iraqis already largely opposed to our presence. But to suggest that the commission of an atrocity will all but doom the war effort is to suggest that the war effort was, from its inception, all but doomed. Atrocities happen in every war. It's the nature of war. Counterinsurgency wars are especially nasty. One should expect bad things to happen when one makes a decision to go to war. If Haditha means that the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq in the future is unlikely to be productive, then what it means is that there was never any chance that our soldiers' presence would be productive in the first place, because atrocities were all but inevitable. Which, I suspect, is not what Representative Murtha was trying to say, although it may well be true. And in terms of worse than Abu Ghraib, I get kind of fuzzy as to why the moral fallout from the actions of a dozen mostly low-ranking Marines will be worse than that of torture policies that killed dozens crafted and approved at the highest levels of U.S. government. I'm also having a hard time understanding why the average Iraqi should care about the cold-blooded murders of a couple dozen more civilians when somewhere between 40,000 and 200,000 civilians have already died as a result of this war, and another 500,000 civilians died as a result of the economic sanctions that preceded it. What's the difference between the cold-blooded executions, if that's what happened in Haditha, and soldiers that proceed despite the statistical certainty of massive collateral damage? The oops, we weren't really aiming for them in defense might make our soldiers and the queasy American public feel better about civilian deaths we've caused halfway around the world, but to survivors, loved ones, and the Iraqi countrymen who will be the ultimate judges of whether U.S. soldiers' success has been undermined, I doubt that it makes much difference at all. Dead is dead. If it's at the hands of a foreign occupier, how inclined would you be to either take an uninvestigated claim of that was an accident at face value, or to forgive the perpetrators? The cover-up of Haditha is even less of a shock than the original atrocity. From Abu Ghraib to White Phosphorus to Pat Tillman and Jessica Lynch, virtually every major story in the last 3 years involving the battlefield has involved either fanciful storytelling or serious butt-covering by the Pentagon. The tone starts with George W. Bush and oozes its way down the chain of command. Have Iraqis caught on to the fact that official America lies routinely? Sure they have. It's patronizing and insulting to think otherwise. Should Iraqis be angry, and will they be angry, about what happened at Haditha? Of course. But I very much doubt that they're surprised, and we shouldn't be either. This is what war smells like. Iraqis know that all too well. The sooner Americans figure it out, the better. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jock Parrish.
That was Rose Gerber with The Enemy Is Right. You're listening to Making Waves. And now for some news from Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The issue of network neutrality is now the number one telecommunications issue facing the U.S. Congress. As a result, lawmakers are looking to associate their names with internet freedom, and this has led to an explosion of competing bills pending in the House and Senate. There are six pieces of legislation in all. The two front runners are the Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act in the House and the Communications Consumers Choice and Broadband Deployment Act in the Senate. Both of these bills deal with a wide range of telecom issues and thus are likely to be the legislative vehicles that will ultimately come up for votes. And although they have nice names, the bad news is neither of the bills contain any meaningful provisions when it comes to protecting internet freedom. The COPE Act allows the FCC to investigate cases of data discrimination, but it's prohibited from actually making rules on the subject, while the Senate omnibus bill simply asks the FCC to study net neutrality and report back to Congress. That's why four other bills have been introduced explicitly dealing with the issue. In the House, the frontrunner is the Internet Freedom and Non-Discrimination Act, which has bipartisan sponsorship and treats net neutrality as an antitrust issue. This bill cleared the House Judiciary Committee late last month, although Republican House leadership may conspire to keep the bill from coming up to the floor for a full vote. The other House bill, the Network Neutrality Act of 2006, currently languishes in the House's Commerce Committee. On the Senate side, two similar bills await review by the Senate Commerce Committee, the Internet Freedom Preservation Act and Internet Non-Discrimination Act, both of which would essentially prohibit phone and cable companies from extorting cash from online content providers in exchange for smooth service. The Internet Freedom Preservation Act also has bipartisan sponsorship. At a recent Senate Commerce Committee hearing on network neutrality, Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott put the political momentum for preserving an open internet into some impressive perspective.
Together, the audience of the net neutrality bloggers exceeds the readership of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post combined. This is the online democratic public sphere in potent action.
And in an exchange with Senator Byron Dorgan, a Democrat from North Dakota and one of the co-sponsors of the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, Scott warned the Congress that those who oppose network neutrality do so at their own peril.
And what are the consequences if the Congress says, you know what, let's do nothing and whatever happens, happens out there?
I think that the hundreds of thousands of people that are currently engaged will become tens of millions, and we'll suddenly see a revolt on the internet, the likes of which has never occurred before.
The weakest of the Senate bills is expected to come up for a vote before the Commerce Committee in a couple of weeks, while a full House vote on the COPE Act is expected any day now. Meanwhile, phone and cable companies continue to shovel money into fake coalitions and an avalanche of advertising that tries to portray internet freedom as some sort of quasi-socialist concept. They're still spending at least $1 million a week on this campaign. The Save the Internet Coalition has spent less than 1% of that in total and has managed to unite groups ranging from the Christian Coalition to the Feminist Majority with more than 5,000 blogs, nearly 10,000 MySpace friends, and more than 750,000 signatories to a petition to Congress asking it to protect free speech online.
At first glance, Bowling Green, Ohio might not seem like a mecca for independent media making, but for one weekend in June, it becomes one when the Allied Media Conference comes to town.
This is our eighth year, and we're really building a community of people that are trying to radically transform the way we see media, the way we use media to change the world.
That's Josh Breitbart, one of the conference organizers. Several hundred media activists of all stripes will converge on the campus of Bowling Green State University from June 23rd to the 25th for this year's AMC, whose theme is From Truth to Power, Because Being Right is Not Enough, designed to challenge independent media makers on what their ultimate aims should be.
Because of the tendency that we've seen for independent media to report information and then stop and feel like that that's enough. And yet, historical circumstances seem to have shown us that that's not enough.
The AMC weekend features a plethora of workshops and panels covering a wide range of issues, from the basics of organizing around media to how to make media policy more understandable and actionable. A film festival is also part of the weekend. Visit AlliedMediaConference.org for the full rundown.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is Making Waves, and now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Charlie Richardson of the group Military Families Speak Out, who looks at the ongoing war in Iraq from the perspective of relatives who have loved ones serving in the war. Josh Rubner of the US Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, who explains why his group is opposed to the Palestinian Anti-Terrorism Act, recently passed in the US House of Representatives. And Charlie Cray, director of the Center for Corporate Policy, who discusses the guilty verdict delivered against Enron executives Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling and government deregulation, which played an important role in Enron's collapse. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Interpress Service reports that in 2003, Iran, under the reformist president Mohammad Khatami, offered a comprehensive peace deal to the Bush administration. It included recognition of Israel and a cutoff of aid to Palestinian militia groups like Hamas that engaged in terror attacks within Israel's 1967 borders. The offer was quickly dismissed by the Bush White House, says former National Security Council staffer Flint Leverett. A copy of the Iranian negotiating paper was obtained by Trita Parsi, a scholar at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. In return for ending aid to Palestinian armed groups, Islamic Iran wanted formal recognition from the United States. The secret paper showed Iran's government was willing to embrace the 2002 policy declaration by the Arab League, accepting the land for peace formula that called for Israel to withdraw to its 1967 borders. The peace deal offered to accept tighter inspections from the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, in exchange for full access to peaceful nuclear technology. Iran's controversial nuclear program is now before the UN Security Council and has triggered threats of military action by Washington. Support for the peace proposal remained active in Iran until 2005, until the election of hardline President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The London-based Guardian newspaper reports major food giants like Cargill and McDonald's are fueling the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. A six-year Greenpeace investigation links cutting of virgin rainforests to the European production of chicken McNuggets, made from poultry grown on soy feed. Cargill sells seeds and chemicals to local farmers to grow hundreds of thousands of tons of soy every year and has 13 soy grain storage facilities in the Brazilian rainforest. The soybeans are exported to Liverpool, England, where they are used as animal feed for chickens raised by a Cargill-owned subsidiary. The company supplies McDonald's with 50% of all the chicken parts it sells in Europe. In 2005, 10,000 square miles of Amazon rainforest were bulldozed to make room for soy farmers. Much of the rainforest destruction near Santarém, Brazil, can be blamed on Cargill's activities in building grain silos and constructing a port for exports. As a result, deforestation rates have doubled and land prices have skyrocketed. As Greenpeace concludes, large-scale soy farming leads to soil erosion. It requires massive chemical inputs to increase harvests. As farmers move on to new land, they repeat the vicious cycle of soil degradation and chemical pollution. The families who own major American brands like Campbell Soup, M&M Mars Candy, and retail giant Walmart are working to repeal the progressive federal estate tax. These super-rich families have bankrolled a decade-long campaign to demonize the inheritance tax, first enacted in 1916. Conservatives now call it the death tax and a handicap to small business and family farmers. According to a study by Public Citizen and United for a Fair Economy, only the top 0.25% of all estates paid the estate tax in 2005, but repeal would cost the U.S. Treasury $1 trillion over a decade. Most of the estate tax benefits would go to a select group of the super rich, who would save over $71 billion. Repeal would also deepen existing trends of American economic inequality. Since 1980, the portion of income held by the top 10% of Americans has doubled, while the relative income of everyone else has fallen. Currently, the top 1% of all taxpayers own 33% of the nation's wealth and 40% of all stocks and bonds. As Public Citizen President Joan Claybrook declared, this long-running, secretive campaign funded by some of the wealthiest families has relied on deception to bamboozle the public. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
As the US commemorated the nation's war dead on Memorial Day, May the 29th, the killing in Iraq continued with the death of 31 Iraqis in bombings and shootings, an American soldier and two crewmen working for CBS News. Dozens of others were injured. The roadside bombing, which claimed the lives of the news crew, also critically wounded CBS correspondent Kimberly Dozier. Escalating bloodshed in Iraq comes as the public is getting new details of what appears to be the execution of 24 Iraqi civilians, men, women and children, at the hands of US Marines last November in the western city of Haditha. While the costs of war are the focus of official attention on one day of the year in the US, anxiety and heartache are something that the families of both Iraqis and Americans killed or injured in the conflict must live with on a daily basis. Thus far, more than 2,400 U.S. servicemen and women have died with tens of thousands injured. Estimates of Iraqi civilians killed in the war range from nearly 40,000 to 100,000. In the fall of 2002, Nancy Lesson and her husband Charlie Richardson attended an anti-war rally in Washington, D.C. Their son was a Marine who would soon be deployed to Iraq. They met another military family opposed to the war and co-founded the group Military Families Speak Out to give voice to the families who would bear the brunt of US policy in the Middle East. Since then, nearly 3,000 families have joined. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Military Families Speak Out co-founder Charlie Richardson, who looks at the conduct of the war and the efforts of many with loved ones in the military to end the conflict.
Memorial Day is a day to remember those who have given so much in service to the country, and certainly we started out this week at the funeral of the son of a dear friend who recently was killed in Iraq, a young Marine, and it brings a certain poignancy to Memorial Day because we certainly are remembering not only him but all the others who have given their lives. I think that in terms of the war in Iraq, Memorial Day is also a day to recommit to saying we don't want any more. We don't want any more names to be added to the list of those who have died as a result of this war, who have died as a result of the lies told by the administration, who have died as a result of the callous disregard for the lives of those who have volunteered and who have volunteered to give so much for their country.
Well, as more than 2,400 U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq, and then, of course, the Bush administration is saying we have to stay the course, we can't cut and run, quote-unquote. Democrats, by and large, are sticking to that line of the day. They're not really veering off it very much, if at all, despite public opinion, which has the majority of people in the United States saying that the war was founded on lies. It was a war that was unnecessary to fight, and growing numbers of people are advocating a withdrawal of U.S. troops there. What are your thoughts, Charlie?
We think the cut and run is actually a real misdirection of the discussion. It's not about cutting and running. It's about we shouldn't have been there in the first place. And the military occupation of Iraq is the problem, not the solution. You know, we should be learning that you cannot invade a country, you cannot occupy a country, and use military force to create a stable society. We are, in fact, the source of instability in that society, and we are the source of a growing hatred of Americans, not only in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but around the world. It's not cutting and running to say we did the wrong thing, and now we're going to fix it, and the way we fix it is first and foremost by ending the occupation, and then, and only then, can we start talking about what we need to do to support the rebuilding of Iraq, because we certainly have a responsibility to support that, but it cannot be done at the end of a gun.
Charlie, we had news in the last couple of weeks about a possible massacre of Iraqi civilians at the hands of U.S. Marines. It looks like anywhere between 15 and 24 civilians, including many small children and women, were killed execution style by the U.S. Marines there in the town of Haditha in western Iraq. What do you think the significance of the Haditha and the killings there are?
Well, first, what I would say is that the military is talking about filing charges against the troops who were involved, and yet, you know, what we want to see and what the questions we want to see asked are about the involvement of the upper levels, who sent those troops in, who has contributed to the cover-up of this. But most of all, most seriously of all, who created the situation that leads to this? The My Lai massacre, this apparent massacre at Haditha, over 2 years ago, we asked a friend of ours to write a piece on the fact that when you occupy a country, it is almost inevitable that these kinds of things happen. He wrote a piece called Hold On to Your Humanity. Because what he knew, and he was a Vietnam vet, what he knew was that these kind of occupations actually work to steal the humanity of our soldiers. But the ones who are really to blame, the ones who really should face the music for this, are those who made the decision to send the troops in, are those who trained the troops, who taught the troops to demean and dehumanize not just the so-called enemy, but the Iraqi people, and in fact Muslims overall. Those are the people who should be held responsible.
I think the Bush administration, looking ahead to the November congressional elections, is really hoping that they can move the shells around on the table a little bit and remove some troops, you know, cycle them in, and then maybe cycle them back after the election to signal to the American people that the war is drawing down, when in actuality it may not be. We may be very far away from that moment.
You know, frankly, I'm really tired of people playing politics with the lives of our young people. There should be a commitment to getting the troops out, to bringing them home now. We have to be very careful to watch for the kind of political manipulation that you're talking about. Bring, you know, 10 or 15,000 troops home before the election to make it sound like we're moving in the right direction. But the bottom line is, people constantly give us milestones. They're saying, when we reach this milestone, then maybe we can start drawing down. When we reach that milestone, we've gotten a whole series of milestones, and the bottom line is that all we see is gravestones.
That was Charlie Richardson of the group Military Families Speak Out. Call the group at area code 617-983-0710. Or visit their website at www.mfso.org. Since January, when Hamas won the Palestinian parliamentary election, the Bush administration and the US Congress have withheld American aid and are working to prevent other funds from reaching the Palestinian people. Israel, the US, and European Union consider Hamas to be a terrorist group due to the group's suicide bombings and other attacks against Israel. Critics say the US government is in effect punishing the Palestinian people for voting in Hamas in an internationally recognized free and fair election, complicating Washington's effort to convince the world that it is promoting democracy in the Middle East.
Just before leaving for the Memorial Day break, the House of Representatives passed the Palestinian Anti-Terrorism Act, H.R. 4681. The legislation's many provisions would deny any support to the Palestinian Authority unless its leaders comply with a long list of demands that could make any future sovereign Palestinian state unviable. The Bush administration, while pursuing its own agenda to limit Hamas's ability to govern, has stated the House bill is unnecessary. The Senate has yet to vote on a similar measure that has 86 co-sponsors, but lacks the support of Republican leaders of key committees such as Lincoln Chafee and Richard Lugar. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Josh Rubner of the US Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, a coalition of more than 200 groups founded in 2002. Rubner explains the consequences of the bill for Palestinians and the peace process.
Supporters of H.R. 4681, the Palestinian Anti-Terrorism Act, like to portray this bill as simply being a way to shut off any funding to Hamas or to the Palestinian Authority. In reality, though, that step was completely unnecessary because under current U.S. law, before this resolution had passed, no direct aid could be given to the Palestinian Authority in any case without a presidential waiver. And there are numerous laws that prevent the United States from giving any direct aid to any organization that it considers to be a foreign terrorist organization. And a few anti-Palestinian members of Congress pushed this legislation through kind of a grab bag of different anti-Palestinian agenda items that they've been working on for years. Under the guise of punishing Hamas or restricting contact with Hamas, the authors of this bill are also trying to shut down the PLO's diplomatic mission to the UN, its office in Washington, D.C., and to make it very difficult, if not impossible, for any Palestinian politicians to travel to the United States. The way that the bill defines the Palestinian Authority is to include members of the Palestinian Legislative Council, regardless of their political affiliation. So even so-called moderates who reject violence, who accept the peace process, who accept a two-state solution to the conflict, even people like that are going to be excluded from the United States under the provisions of this bill if it were to become law.
The bill requires the Palestinians to do many things, some specific and some general. Just a couple of examples: to recognize the State of Israel, to accept the four-power roadmap as a way of getting to a two-state solution, to ensure institutional and financial transparency and accountability.
The whole issue of recognizing Israel, I think, is a bit of a red herring. Israel does exist, whether Hamas wants to recognize it or not. But where is the pressure being put on Israel, for example, to recognize Palestinian human rights individually and collectively in terms of their national rights? Israel has never honored the collective human rights of the Palestinian people to freedom and self-determination, and we continue to give Israel $3 billion a year of aid, yet we don't condition that and expect Israel to recognize the legitimate national aspirations of the Palestinian people. It's quite hypocritical.
Some opponents of the bill say that it would prevent food and medical care from reaching the Palestinian people. Is that true?
There is an exemption for some forms of humanitarian aid in the House version of the bill, but it's defined very narrowly and very specifically to only encompass what the House calls basic human health needs. So, for example, most of the U.S. aid that has flowed to the Palestinians over the past decade, for example, has been for the development of infrastructure. That would be cut off. Any types of funding for educational projects. And what's even more critical in terms of this is not what this particular resolution says, but it's what the Bush administration is threatening banks worldwide with, and that is that any bank that transfers money to the Palestinian Authority to pay its employees, and the employees are not just security service people, by the way. The employees of the Palestinian Authority are primarily doctors, nurses, teachers. All those services are publicly run and funded, and they haven't been paid in 3 months. And the United States is threatening any bank that transfers money to the Palestinian Authority to pay these doctors, nurses, teachers with sanctions under anti-terrorism financing laws.
The bill also calls for the Palestinians to hold free and fair elections, I think something that could be argued doesn't exist in the U.S. in all cases. But I haven't heard anybody, including the U.S. government, say that the recent Palestinian elections weren't free and fair.
Well, the elections were widely regarded as free and fair, and I haven't heard any assessment to the contrary. We have this notion that the basis of our foreign policy in general, and towards the Middle East in particular, is based upon the promotion of democracy abroad. Well, here we have an example of people undertaking a legitimate, multi-party, contested election, free of violence, free of intimidation, much more than you could say for our so-called ally of Egypt. And what you have in response, Congress proposes and then the House enacts the most comprehensive set of sanctions targeting the Palestinian people that have ever been proposed in the history of Congress.
That was Josh Rubner of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Call the group at area code 202-332-0994 or visit their website at www.endtheoccupation.org. The guilty verdict delivered against Enron chief executives Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling on fraud and conspiracy charges came 5 years after the energy giant's 2001 collapse. Enron's failure cost stockholders $60 billion, employees lost $2 billion in pension funds, and 5,600 lost their jobs. Skilling faces a possible 185 years in jail, while Lay, Enron's founder, could spend up to 45 years in prison. Before Enron's deep problems were exposed, Ken Lay was one of President Bush's and the Republican Party's biggest contributors. Lay used his influence with the White House to help shape the administration's energy policy and promote corporate deregulation. Enron played a role in California's 2001 electricity crisis, where energy speculators like Ken Lay made millions and consumers suffered rolling blackouts and skyrocketing utility bills. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Charlie Cray, director of the Center for Corporate Policy, who looks at the guilty verdict delivered against Lay and Skilling, as well as the government deregulation, which played an important role in Enron's collapse.
There were an array of charges that had to do with conspiracy, wire fraud, securities fraud, falsifying business records, and insider trading. And largely the charges had to do with the statements they made in the final year before Enron collapsed about how Enron stock was a good buy, statements made to both employees and investors at quarterly and annual meetings.
Maybe you could give us a little background regarding Enron and Ken Lay's massive contributions to President Bush himself as a candidate in the Republican Party in general over many years.
There's no other presidential family that has had such a prolonged relationship on behalf of a single corporation that I can recall than the Bush family's relationship to Enron. In 2000, during the campaign, it was obvious, you know, Ken Lay was one of the pioneers. Bush and Cheney flew on Enron jets during the campaign. You know, the relationship that Enron had with the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2000 was very intimate, and of course, as soon as Enron collapsed, all of a sudden, Kenny Boy became Mr. Lay, and despite the fact that there were 40 ex-Enron employees, lobbyists, and consultants that were in the Bush administration at the time of Enron's collapse, and the fact that Enron had made a play to get help from the Treasury Department and other branches of government. You know, the administration, I think, succeeded in distancing itself. It was sort of a preposterous thing, stating that, for instance, Ari Fleischer said this was a business scandal. It had nothing to do with government.
Charlie, a lot of people, of course, look at the last few years of the Bush administration and talk about an era of crony capitalism, the failure of Tyco, WorldCom, Enron, Adelphia. Big accounting firms went down. What's the common denominator?
Well, what we had was sort of an ideological era of the promise that deregulation and laissez-faire economics would allow the market to discipline and punish the errant players more effectively than government does. Enron was kind of a corporate Chernobyl that exposed the dark side of American corporate capitalism. And there were really four primary causes of these scandals, that most of which had not been addressed. The first would be the executive compensation system that created an incentive to cook the books, the broad use of stock options, those steroids for corporate greed that created an incentive to meet quarterly earnings per share targets and pump up the value of the stock so they could cash out before the whole facade crashed down. And that happened at company after company. The second cause, which was deregulation. The third cause that most people are not aware of was a set of laws that are broadly described as tort reform laws. These made it more difficult for defrauded investors to sue the aiders and abettors of fraud. And then finally, you had a gutting of enforcement budgets at the Securities and Exchange Commission, which over the course of a decade had assumed an extraordinarily huge increase in responsibility through the expansion of the markets that they were supposed to oversee. You had an overworked agency.
Charlie, what do the prospects look like on Capitol Hill for corporate regulation reform, reimposing some regulations that worked very well after the Depression that have been removed since the era of Ronald Reagan moving forward?
I think that the public would like to see something happen. I don't think Capitol Hill is ready. I think they feel that they did what they could with Sarbanes-Oxley. The debate over Enron and the other scandals was narrowed down to the question of accounting reform. They did a fairly good job in some respects, but they didn't really finish the job. I think the right has succeeded very well in convincing Americans that government is the source of the problem and not corporations, when actually government, when it is a problem, is acting on behalf of corporations and is a captive of corporate interests. So for us to remedy the situation, we have to fight for our rights against corporate rights, and we have to look for every opportunity to do that at the local level as well as the national level. And until we build a movement challenging corporate power, we're going to be continuously under assault by the other side.
That was Charlie Cray, director of the Center for Corporate Policy and co-author of The People's Business, Controlling Corporations and Restoring Democracy. Contact the center by calling area code 202-387-8030 or visit the group's website at www.corporatepolicy.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tarr. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by Howard Zinn. Civil disobedience is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Our problem is that numbers of people all over the world have obeyed the dictates of the leaders of their government and have gone to war, and millions have been killed of this obedience. Our problem is that people are obedient all over the world in the face of poverty and starvation and stupidity and war and cruelty. Our problem is that people are obedient while the jails are full of petty thieves, and all the while, the grand thieves are running and robbing the country. That's our problem.